Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Substance use disorder in adults has been on the rise since the start of the pandemic, and tragically, we've seen a rise in opioid overdose and death. Is that the case in teens and young adults? Today, we discuss what puts teens at higher risk for substance use and some warning signs of kids struggling and how schools, parents, and the community can all play a role in preventing substance use in teens. Later in the hour, we hear the story of one mother's journey through her daughter's addiction to heroin and her subsequent recovery after 13 overdoses. But first, what has been the impact of the pandemic on the social and emotional well-being of teens? Are we seeing a rise in substance use in this age group since the start of the pandemic? And what are some of the warning signs we should be aware of? Joining us is Teresa Manning. She's the Executive Director of the Martha's Vineyard Youth Task Force. Welcome back, Teresa.
Thank you.
Also with us is Melissa McGuire, Director of Student Services at the Monomoy Regional School District. Welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And we welcome Julie Kingston to the program. She's a licensed clinical social worker at the middle and high school in Nantucket. Julie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Teresa, tell us a little bit more about the history and mission of the Martha's Vineyard Youth Task Force.
The Martha's Vineyard Youth Task Force originated around 2006 in our community based on some health survey data that was being populated around the adult use in our community. And at that time, there were a few community members who felt that it would be worthwhile to utilize what data had already been collected since 1999 in our community around youth substance use, and to try and look at ways to maintain that data collecting effort and to look for support with evidence-based impacts for those numbers. At the time when the Youth Task Force came around, our use rates, particularly for alcohol, were much higher than state and national averages. And so we had a real opportunity to try and look at why that was happening here in our community. And over the past 15 years or so, we've been quite successful in impacting those numbers by really strengthening the safety net and looking to the community to utilize environmental strategies to see where are the inroads that we can make to help support kids to make better decisions.
In March of 2020, when lockdowns began and students were transitioned to remote learning, what were some of the concerns you had about the impacts of isolation on teens and adolescents?
So certainly we were really paying attention to and working closely with community services, and they have a division called the Islandwide Youth Collaborative, and they work much more on direct services for families and youth. And we worked really closely with them because the concerns revolve around isolation, depression, mental health challenges, in potential increased suicide risk. What we found was that those were things that were of concern, and community services implemented some support services and supports for families around that, as did the school. But interestingly, and I in preparing for talking to you today, anecdotally, we were hearing a lot of stories throughout the pandemic of seeing an increased risk and activity around middle school students. Our middle school students here on the Vineyard have traditionally been much used at a much lower rate than state and national averages. And we look to sort of strengthen those protective factors that seem to be working in our community. And so we were hearing, we didn't have survey data to back this up initially, but we were hearing that there were clusters of kids that were using alcohol, in particular alcohol and vaping, at a increased rate. And it developed a lot of concern around parents. Obviously, and schools. And so we did a lot of initiatives around that, a lot of parent meetings, dinners, remote dinners, where we gave them resources and really tried to help parents understand that this is not normal, and some strategies to dealing with that. We actually found that in the high school, because we have done a survey at the end of last school year, our rates decreased for high school use, and our rates decreased for middle school, contrary to our anecdotal information. Yeah. And, you know, in doing our work, we look at reasons why that might be the case. And I think, you know, our survey data records in high school and middle school, that kind of activity is typically around social gatherings and the diminished social gatherings, big parties, things like that, where kids might report having used alcohol in the last 30 days might have been at a big party that they happen to attend, and they don't really have ongoing access to that opportunity. And certainly through the pandemic, that wasn't happening.
Yeah.
And I'll just say real quickly, with middle school students, we think that the access might have increased a little because they were home socializing with their older siblings. And so there's probably something to that. So we really worked on helping parents understand that risk and be more cognizant of it and provide better supports around that.
Yeah. Melissa, humans are social beings. Most of us need some sort of connection to others, but during those adolescent and teenage years, social connections are part of their development. Explain why.
So when you move certainly from an elementary school level where you really are engaged socially all day long, you're with the same kids all day long, and you're primarily with the same teacher all day long. So you're really building those strong connections. Once you move into the middle school, and of course, as we know, adolescent development and all that goes with that is very challenging. There's a huge shift. There's a huge shift in expectations, in what you are expected academically to access and understand, as well as socially, because the dynamics of those social groups change. Your teachers change, your social groups change. And that moves right into high school, where then you see almost a settling of relationships that they've formed, they've strengthened, and kids are together because they have like interests. So the middle school years are the most powerful to really look at what those relationship skill building is, because it is the most critical time. And it's an area we focus on. And I do have some data at some point to share regarding our middle school students, because it was fascinating in terms of the relationship skills and social emotional learning skills. Actually, I can share it now. There was a very high correlation to our what's called our CELIS, which is the social emotional learning indicator system that we administer twice a year. And that really addresses the five core competencies of social emotional learning. There was a high correlation to student growth and the responses on the social emotional learning indicator system. And we partner with the Department of Elementary and Secondary Ed. So when Sheila Peoples, who I work with at the state, sent this like with huge exclamation points, wow, that focus on relationship skills clearly is paying off. And so we're thrilled to see that. It certainly doesn't negate the students who are still struggling. And at some point, unless you would like me to do it now, I can share some of those questions that we ask students and, you know, some of the responses. And again, we do that in the fall and the spring. But what we saw for some of our kiddos, especially the middle school kids, is that lack of socialization, that they became so isolated, and that came through loud and clear. Mm-hmm. It came through observably through them just shutting themselves off on the screen, because there wasn't that opportunity to turn and talk, you know, to take a break, to do any of those things, to walk through a hallway and talk about what are you doing today? You know, how's, you know, this going with your sports or whatever the case was, that was completely removed from building those skills. So I'm impressed that our students continued to grow in that realm. But as they came back last year, that's where we saw a real gap in those skills, because they almost forgot, what am I supposed to do? What am I expected to do? So not only did we expect them to handle a traumatic event, which was the pandemic, because that was, we expected them to do the same thing they've always done, which is to learn, you know, in an environment that is completely different from what they've, you know, lived for the past, you know, however many years they've been in school. So we continue to see that even now. I'm most concerned about our eighth graders, believe it or not. Our eighth grade is in the high school. And the reason I'm most concerned about them is because the last 2 years in their middle school years, there's such a deficit in their development with those social relationships, with the self-management, with the self-awareness, with responsible decision-making. And now we're expecting them to come in. And now just think about that, 2 years, middle school is only three. Okay, so they've lost 2 years of those that skill development. Now we're expecting them to come into a high school independent, knowing what to do while they're in the classroom, knowing how to learn. And that's just not the case. And so we're seeing a significant increase in the mental health challenges that kids are facing. and the lack of resources to truly support those needs at higher levels.
Julie, pre-pandemic, what were some of the more common social emotional challenges you were seeing in students, and how did that change during the remote or hybrid learning period of the pandemic?
I would agree with the current, the previous speaker in that, you know, kids generally are social beings. We're all social beings. And when we lost that opportunity to have face-to-face contact with one another, I think that that really was traumatic. It was a loss, a significant loss for our students. And I think, you know, we did the best that we could through virtual sessions with kids to support them. But again, when you don't have eyes on students, it's very hard to see what really is going on. A lot of students wouldn't turn their cameras on because, you know, they didn't have either private space at home, or they were concerned about what people might see or think if the camera was on and they noticed things. So it was really challenging to properly assess and evaluate how kids were doing because they weren't in front of us. And I think we rely so heavily on what teachers see in the classrooms. We rely on what students see in one another. If they've got a concern, you know, they typically would report that to a trusted adult. And so we lost that component of actually having kids in front of us to be able to assess how they're doing and what they may need.
So Julie, how did you and others at Nantucket Public Schools try to ensure you were identifying and engaging students who might be struggling during the pandemic? Sounds like it was quite a challenge.
Yeah. I relied a lot on Google Chat because kids could reach out to me at any point in time. And they actually did a good job of doing that if they were concerned about themselves or a friend. And we also had parents reaching out to school staff to say, I'm noticing or I'm worried about what I'm seeing in my son or daughter and their friend group. So it was very concerning in the sense that, you know, when you don't have eyes on kids, that's a missing piece. Mm-hmm. And so we had to rely on technology, which I'm not saying it's not good, but it's not the same as having students in front of you where you can notice their behavior, where you can see the work that they're producing and see if there's changes that are concerning.
Yeah. We're discussing what puts teens at higher risk for substance use and warning signs kids are struggling and how schools, parents, and the community can all play a role in preventing substance use in teens. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. Listening to The Point, and we are talking about the impact of the pandemic on the social and emotional well-being of teens and what puts teens at a higher risk for substance use. With us is Teresa Manning. She's the executive director of the Martha's Vineyard Youth Task Force. Melissa McGuire is director of student services at Monomoy Regional School District. And Julie Kingston is a licensed clinical social worker in the middle and high school on Nantucket. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Most of the schools have been back in person learning since the start of the school year. For some students, that might mean they're feeling a little more connected now, but for others, there might have been anxiety and stress about being back in school. Teresa, how are students coping with being back in school person learning?
I think it is a big adjustment time. From working with our schools here, we're finding that kids are needing to reach out for more support in the counseling. Adjustment counselors are very busy. Parents are sort of also struggling with that transition. And so we're finding that we're taking the time to find out what new supports people need, but kids are definitely needing help reconnecting and re-engaging in a present place.
Yeah. Melissa, you mentioned the eighth graders. What else are you saying about students' needs now that they're back in school?
We're seeing quite a bit of need in terms of just adjusting to the different expectations. So kids are still expected to socially distance. They're still expected to wear masks throughout the whole day. So there's right there a barrier for kids to engage as they typically might, you know, socially at both the middle and the high school level. But when I look at our results from our fall CELIS, which is the Social Emotional Learning Indicator System, I just want to give you some examples because this gives us some immediate ability to look at students and their responses to questions. So for example, question is, you know what my strengths are. So the responses are easy, very easy, hard, very hard, or, you know, unsure. And so when I kind of look at that of our students, you know, 7% say it's really hard. So, okay, that's, you know, who are those students? We can look at who those students are. What worries me is when I get to a question like knowing ways to make myself feel better when I'm sad. And 16%, this is just the high schoolers, 16% say that's really hard for me. And it's actually more, it's like 20% between very hard and hard. For me, that's a red flag. If that's really hard for them to know what to do when they're sad, I really want to connect with those students. I want our counselors to connect. And the beautiful thing about this survey is we see the responses immediately. And what it produces is what's called a SWAN map, but it really looks at a student's cluster of responses to all those five core SEL competencies. And so we can say, wow, we're really concerned about that student. He hasn't necessarily, or she hasn't been a red flag in the past. However, these responses tell me something's going on. So we can really deploy folks to check in with students. Our counselors also have immediate access. So a student can sit in a classroom and go to their Google link to say, I need to see you, without having to really be worried about someone, you know, raising the hand and saying, can I go, you know, to guidance? Because that's a huge piece too. You know, kids are really worried about what others are thinking about them. So we have that, those options available for students. We also partner with Gosnold. We have Gosnold counselors in all of our schools so that they have access to that resource where they might not otherwise after school. So we have lots of different resources available for our students, but those are the concerns, you know, I'm looking at, you know, all of these different questions. And we also just did the youth risk behavior survey. I don't have those results. I'm looking very much forward to those results to see comparatively how, you know, students are responding in comparison to our CELIS data. And the additional survey that we do is an actual relationship survey, which really points out for students, you know, do they have a trusted adult that they can go to? And we actually ask them to name that person. Mm-hmm. You know, who is that? Because we also want them to know it doesn't have to be a teacher. It could be our custodian staff. It could be a cafeteria worker. But really building the confidence for our kids to develop those strong relationships and trusting relationships. So there's lots of different ways that we are observing student struggles. And again, of course, in the classroom, kids are most definitely struggling in the classroom to remain in the classroom in a little bubble, right? Because desks are, you know, 3 feet apart. You can't do that group work anymore. You can't, you know, kind of walk down the hall with, you know, shoulder to shoulder. So we're really paying attention to that very closely and really working with our families where the students are struggling at a high level of need. You know, we've certainly seen more hospitalizations this year than we've seen in the past, which I'm very concerned about because we have kids boarding at home, meaning there aren't beds. So mm-hmm. kids are being sent home that have been identified with a high level of mental health care need, and there are no beds for kids. So that's a daily work that I'm doing with our schools and families. So that's a huge concern.
Julie, what about in Nantucket?
You know, very similar. We also do the signs of suicide screening every year so that we can try to identify kids that are struggling. But I concur that having a trusting a relationship that's trusting with an adult could be a custodian, as you said, or it could be a teacher. You know, when kids have someone that they can go to, I think for the most part, they do that. So I think, you know, we use the DESA screener is another piece of, you know, I'm going to say it's clinically trusted in terms of assessing how kids are doing. But I also think that kids do a good job looking out for one another. And if they're worried about someone, they let someone know, which is really important. The other piece that we're noticing is an increase in disordered eating, which is something that is both in middle and high school. And I don't know sort of whether that's just kids being isolated again and the trauma associated with that, but we're seeing a real uptick in disordered eating and referrals for services around that.
Yeah. And Melissa, you touched on this, the resources, you know, not finding beds and even just, you know, the numbers of people that are children and adults seeking, you know, mental health counselors, we can't keep up with demand. That's gotta be a real challenge. And I'm wondering how, Julie, let's start with you. How are you all dealing with that, with you know, the lack of resources?
Right. It is difficult. And especially in terms of just cultural sensitivity, you know, we have a need for kids to be able to access services in multiple languages, not just in terms of, you know, English, but we have a high Latino population, Portuguese speaking population, and the wait list for services, it's extensive. And that's another frustrating piece, because when people need access to services, you know, they don't have the opportunity to wait or the luxury of waiting. So it's hard accessing services. We work really closely with our school nurse here. We have a good team response, but there are not enough resources to respond to the overwhelming needs.
Yeah. Teresa, I'm sure you're seeing that on the Vineyard as well, right?
Very much so. We're struggling with keeping clinicians here on the island. When we do get clinicians that are qualified to work with young people, it's very hard to retain them with the cost of living, et cetera. I will say that we've had some success in developing some online resources through the pandemic to be able to broaden our scope, but it just doesn't supplement the importance of in-person counseling services. With translation, we also have a large Brazilian population in our community. We have translators at most of our mental health agencies here, which is wonderful. We have a lot of resources being put into that. It's just not enough.
Yeah. Melissa, same for you, right?
Yes. One of the things we did do last year, though, is we contracted with an organization called Care Solace. And it's an organization that's like a concierge system. So we do what's called a warm handoff, and it's online, and we will connect the family through this kind of referral process. And then what Care Solace does is a live person that spends all of their time with the family, connecting them with a service provider. And the nice thing about Care Solace is they have all of the providers on the, well, almost all the providers. They're still working on building the directory. But if a family is willing to engage in teletherapy, their span is far greater, so that they can really search for a unique therapist or psychiatrist for the family. And it's been wonderful. And I have a dashboard, so I can see all of the families accessing this, how much work is being done through the concierge system. In other words, how many phone calls, how many appointments attended, so that we can then support the family. I know Barnstable is using that as well. So that's been wonderful, because our counselors spend a lot of time doing family care, almost in terms of helping families try to connect to community resources. So this really allows our counselors to get back to really working more deeply with the students. And then the families have one person that can really support that case management.
Yeah. We used to think alcohol and marijuana, we used to think of them as like gateway drugs to more addictive and deadly drugs such as heroin. Teresa, is there such a thing as a gateway drug, and what might be more helpful ways to consider the risks associated with alcohol and marijuana use in teens?
So interestingly enough, I think that using any substance as a young person in their teens is really about learning refusal skills and healthy coping mechanisms, right? And so we find that it doesn't really matter what the substance is that we're looking at. It's the same tools and coping mechanisms that we're trying to teach kids at a young age, which should help them as they grow older. Although opiates are a tremendous issue in our adult population, we obviously, kids don't have access to those substances at the age that we work with them. And so we like to educate them about the risks of opiates, but really we find that alcohol, marijuana, vaping, those are the kind of substances that they have access to, and learning how to navigate those choices, learning about brain research is a very compelling concept for young people and for parents. It's interesting. We've tested it and focus grouped the concepts that resonate with young people, and somehow brain development really does resonate with kids. And when they understand the science, which is newer science for us to understand, it does impact their choices. And that sort of goes for all substances as you age.
Yeah. I've said this many times, but I have to repeat it any opportunity I get. Dr. Ruth Pote, who I'm sure many of you are familiar with.
Wonderful.
She gave this statistic at one point, and I couldn't believe it. If you can keep a child from doing any kinds of drugs or alcohol until their brain is fully developed, you know, at age 24, 20, they have less than 1% chance of becoming an addict. That is just mind-blowing when you think about that. So that brain research is so important.
We've been very fortunate to have her speak in our community a couple times. And I feel like the people who either by the recordings, which we then utilized in parent meetings down the road, or the live presentations, the young people and the adults that hear her science and her message about it, especially as a parent and a doctor. She also talks about the other point around that is that if you are genetically predisposed to addiction, if you wait until that age that you're talking about, 25, 26 years old, to use alcohol, you can 100% eliminate that risk.
Yeah,
and she claims that there's no other disease that that's the case for. And so people respond to that. And we're fortunate to have that research today to be able to help people down the road.
Yeah. Julie, you have anything you want to add to that?
No, I would agree with that. And, you know, as part of our freshman wellness classes, we talk about, or the teachers talk about, you know, risk factors, protective factors, and ways to perhaps make better choices to allow your brain to fully develop, so that when you make decisions around whether you do or don't use, that it's made with good, solid information and science-based research.
Yeah. Melissa, anything you want to add? I think we lost Melissa for a second there. Teresa, talk about the education and prevention campaigns that you and your coalition partners at the Martha's Vineyard Youth and Alliance have undertaken to help adolescents and teens make better choices around drugs and alcohol.
Sure. So we utilize something called environmental strategies. So we don't do a specific curriculum. It's not a school-based project. It really is working with different aspects of our community. So it runs the gamut of taking the data that we collect in the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, we ask paired perception questions in that to try and find places that kids and parents may have a misperception of use rates, where we could help just by educating them about the truth, helps them understand that if the majority of kids are not doing a particular activity, then they're less likely to do it, right? That's the theory. It's peer pressure. So we do a lot of social norms marketing, it's called, where we really correct those misperceptions with facts. We work closely with our business population by helping do a better job with commercial access to alcohol, increasing we put messages on bags at all the package stores that warn people about giving alcohol to young people. We work closely with the school to give resources, bring topical speakers in. We do a lot of activity around parents, really just helping parents feel connected and feel empowered to speak with one another and try and for a while, we felt like when we started, there was sort of this cloak of not wanting to be a busybody and not wanting to check with another parent or judge another parent for what's happening at their house. And we do a lot of work around increasing that communication and empowering parents to feel comfortable doing that, because it really works out in the end. Mm-hmm. We do work with kids around educational brain research, things like that. And then generally we try and do frequent check-ins to see where are the areas where we think kids are getting mixed messages, and try and bring in specific resources for that.
Yeah. Julie, what kinds of programs does Nantucket Public School offer around substance use prevention?
Well, you know, basically, like I said, it's the wellness curriculum for freshmen, where they do focus on mental health, coping strategies, helping kids develop skills and refusal abilities. But, you know, kids will make bad decisions. That's just the reality. And I think, you know, if we give them the skill sets and tools to be able to navigate that, that they'll be in a better position to hopefully make different decisions around substance use. You know, again, I think it's important to let them know that, you know, if you're struggling or if someone is struggling, there is help available, and it's okay to ask for help, but you need to let someone know so that we can make the connections.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, what about Monomoy?
Sure. We actually use Botvin Life Skills, which is an anti-addiction curriculum, and we use that actually grades 3 through 12. In addition to our other social emotional learning curriculum we use. So we have a very strong emphasis on that for each of those grade levels. At the high school, we also do the ESPRT, which is a screening, brief intervention, and referral for treatment, so that that can also give us kind of a insight to where kids are at in terms of substance use. And then, of course, additionally, they're doing more, a deeper dive in the wellness courses at the high school as well.
Yeah. Julie Kingston is a social worker at the Middle and High School on Nantucket. Melissa McGuire is the Director of Student Services at the Monomoy Regional School District. Thank you both for joining us this morning. We really appreciate what you're doing. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for this important session. This is great.
Coming up after break, a mother's journey through her daughter's addiction and recovery and her work helping other families. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing prevention and education around substance use in teens and adolescents this hour. With us is Teresa Manning. She's the executive director of the Martha's Vineyard Youth Task Force. And joining us now is Maureen Cavanaugh. She's the founder of Magnolia New Beginnings, a nonprofit that provides peer support, education, and advocacy to those recovering from a substance use disorder. She's also the author of If You Love Me, A Mother's Journey Through Her Daughter's Opioid Addiction. Maureen, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start by saying, thankfully, your daughter, Katie, was able to find a treatment program that worked for her. She is in recovery. How is she doing today?
Well, the interesting thing is she actually walked into over 40 different entries into treatment. So I wouldn't say that she found the treatment program. Somehow she managed to take a little bit from everywhere she had been and enter recovery and sustain that for the last 4.5 years. She's doing very well. Thank you.
At what age did she start using drugs? And in hindsight, were there personality traits or behaviors that put her at a higher risk for substance use?
So, you know, as probably everybody's aware, like there are, you know, things that we look for when somebody in early drug use, or if somebody has early, you know, some suicidal ideation, or whether they're, or, you know, just typical adolescence. And those things look a lot alike, depending on the person. It's all about severity, of course. So I have 4 children, and I watched her go through high school and behave in a way that was so much easier and so much more pleasant than her older siblings, that I didn't spot the problems that you know, looking back now, I guess, but she didn't start using drugs and alcohol really until she was in college. So it's a little bit different, you know?
Yeah. So how did you find out she was using drugs? And then what was your response?
She came to me. And in her first year of college, that she came to me and told me that she had been experimenting. She was one of these kids that didn't usually, like, if she went on a sleepover, I'd wake up in the morning and at 7 o'clock and she'd be eating cereal at the table because she was the first one to leave. So she was always kind of a little bit of a homebody. When she went away, she really struggled in that first semester. Her way of coping with the struggling was to, you know, do a little drinking and smoking pot and trying to fit in with the group. We have a strong, you know, family genetic predisposition to addiction. And it, although she didn't see it in the house, it was still lurking in there, you know, within her. And I think that, you know, that started to, as a way to kind of little self-soothing. That was her why, because there's always a why. Mm-hmm. And it just, it took hold and took off. And so she came to me and told me that she had been experimenting, that she had tried heroin and she was scared. And we immediately started searching for help for her. And she went into an outpatient program. And I mistakenly thought she would always come to me. I underestimated the power of addiction.
Yeah. What were there resources within like her school community at that point? I mean, what were the resources available to you?
So I was a special ed teacher, and she went to school in the same district that we lived in. And she, it's, you know, similar to the Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket. And we lived in Marblehead, which is sometimes feels like an island and has that same kind of, everybody knows everybody. And, you know, and there really wasn't anything. There was very little. There was a lot of, that's what there was a lot of.
Yeah.
And when she eventually got arrested, as time went on, and as a teacher, having been a teacher there for many years, and having, you know, she worked in the local store, she volunteered in the school, she was very much a part of the community, and, you know, the kid everybody loved, basically, really. When she got arrested, they, not one person reached out.
Wow.
So there's a lot of, there was still, and still is, a tremendous amount of stigma about reaching out and talking about this.
Yeah, for sure. There were periods of time when you were completely out of contact with Katie and you had no idea where she was or how she was doing. Talk about the emotional toll of this and how it impacted your relationship with other loved ones.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, she tried as hard as she could. She tried to at least touch base at some point every day and tell me that she loved me. And, but I had no idea where she was living. She wouldn't tell me because she knows I would have her sectioned. And so it was rough. And, people don't realize that the impact of this on the family is tremendous. There's some research out of the University of Texas Tech that I love by two doctors, Bradshaw and Shumway, and they're showing that there are changes in the brain, in the same parts of the brain that Ruth Pody talks about, the same parts of the brain that govern a craving, that you can see that light up during a craving. Those same parts of the brain light up in a family member when they're faced, when they're presented with the idea that their loved one may get into treatment. So we act in ways very similar to somebody who is having a craving, because we must do these things, even if they don't make any sense, even if they really defy logic or what we promised ourselves. And we do that because I didn't have any help. And I acted in ways that I look back now, that was totally irrational, was not helpful. And I was working out of this base instinct to, I must save my daughter. And instead of doing the things that probably would have been more helpful, doing things that I, you know, all out of that lizard brain, amygdala, no prefrontal cortex, no logic, no reasoning, I must do this. And the same way she was behaving, because her brain was hijacked by the drugs.
So in your work helping individuals and families with addiction, how do you counsel them on getting through this aspect of the disease?
So we have to educate ourselves, and we have to take care of ourselves, and we have to connect with other people. And those three things, when those three things started happening in my life, I started to make changes, and they had a direct impact on her. So if what we're not doing is we're not educating the families, we even during meetings, we're getting together, we're sitting together, and we know we're not alone, which is a wonderful thing, but we're not educating the families to the extent that we need to, because they're our first line there, right? We're not taking care of the families that are supposed to be supporting the loved ones that are struggling. And we have as we were talking about, there's not enough support for the people that are actually struggling. So we have to educate our families. We have to know what we're looking at. I was looking at things in my own house and not seeing them because I didn't know what I was looking at. I talk to so many families and we say, where did all the spoons go? I mean, there were no spoons left in my house. What are all these Q-tips without any cotton on them? What is this? It was all drug paraphernalia, but I didn't know what I was looking at. And I'm a pretty intelligent person. That's I think, you know, also a little streetwise, and I didn't know what any of this stuff was, and it was happening right in front of me.
As parents, we want to help our children, and we often think we can fix the problem, right? So when you pushed Katie to get treatment, or it came to her from get it from dangerous situations, she would often disappear afterwards, shut you out. Mm-hmm. How can families be supportive of a loved one with addiction in a way that doesn't alienate them? Is it even possible?
Yeah, I think that it is. And that's pretty much what I do. And when I work with families, is teach them how to create boundaries for themselves. Boundaries are not punishments. So we're not trying to punish our loved ones. We're trying to create boundaries that work for the family. So if we can do that, if we can become educated and understand that if they were able to do better, they would. And when they are able to do better, they will. And learn how to hold space for people until that happens, and let them know that they're loved and that they're supported and that we're here for them when they're ready to make good decisions. And we're also here from them to love them even when they're not. We don't stop loving people and caring for them when they're doing things that we wish they weren't doing. And that's an old, you know, that cut them off hot rock bottom stuff has got to go.
Yeah. So now that Katie's in recovery, does she talk to you about the importance of meaning, you know, of the unconditional love during those periods when she was struggling? Does she talk about that?
So the title of the book is If You Love Me, right? Because we do that If You Love Me thing with mm-hmm. our kids. If you love me, you would pick up your clothes, and kids do. If you love me, you'd buy me this. And people think sometimes that that's where that came from. Katie tells me now that that love was the thing that kept her going, was that she knew that if she could only stop, her family was there and loved her. But the title of the book, it comes from her saying to me, she could come home after she had about 3 months of sobriety, the longest she had ever had. And she had a recurrence, and she was had gone out one night and used, and was so sad and so disappointed in herself and so just like hopeless. And she came home and she was sitting on my kitchen floor about 3 o'clock in the morning. And I looked at her and I said, Katie, I love you so much, and you're going to die. And she said, if you love me, you'd let me die. Wow. And I thought I knew how she felt, but I didn't really understand the desperation and just how awful this was. I knew, but I didn't really fully understand how much pain she was in. And I think that's what we have to understand when our loved ones are using, is that they're in such incredible pain, that it came from somewhere. There's always a why as to why they got started. And that's the part that we have to figure out in order to help people sustain recovery. But that we also have to become educated and understand the physiology of the brain and physiology of addiction in that way that Ruth Pody talks about it, because that is so important. This is not they're not doing anything to you when they're using, they're mm-hmm. doing it to themselves. And if they could stop, they would, because nobody wants to live like that.
Yeah. Teresa, you mentioned earlier in the program that the majority of teens are not engaging in substance use, and to normalize it as typical teenage behavior is dangerous. Describe how that shift in thinking helps teens and parents make better choices.
Sure. So we always, in middle school, it's really helpful because we've historically had very low rates. So we've had a great amount of success sort of dispelling the myth of it being a rite of passage or something, which was very commonly discussed when we initiated these efforts. So helping parents understand that when their child comes home from a party or a sleepover and they've engaged in behavior that's risky around substances, to understand that this the knee-jerk reaction is always, it's going all over the middle school, everybody's doing it. And to really get numbers and facts around it and be able to help a parent understand that this kind of behavior actually is a red flag that there are supports for, and you can have support in sending a clearer message to understand that this is not normative behavior. By normalizing it, they just think it's no big deal and it's going to happen. And so those protective factors erode and they feel defeated. Same thing goes for kids. If kids understand what we still, with our developing brains, still care about what the majority of people are doing. And so if we understand that we're having a behavior or desiring participating in a behavior that's outside the normal realm, then we may be more apt to consider taking that step and taking that chance. So really that one very small, seemingly small bit of information is very powerful at a young age for parents and for kids. And we still find that on our YRBS, the number one reason, people are always shocked at this, but still when kids report both in middle school and high school, then we give a whole list of options for reasons that kids choose not to use substances. And still the number one reason is parental disapproval.
Wow.
And parents don't think that. We get sort of, you know, we lax into feeling like our kids don't care what we think. And parental disapproval is a very powerful tool to use at this time. Yeah,
Maureen, we know that recovery is a lifelong journey. How do you see your role in that journey? And how do you talk with families about their role in their loved one's recovery?
I think that, you know, that constant education and that that we need to do on our own, separate, and our own recovery too, because families go into their own separate recovery when they're getting past this and going through this process. And I think that their job is really to work on themselves and to practice good self-care and to update themselves on the latest facts about what's out there and the treatments available for it so that they can be a resource. But also to, this is something somebody is a, unfortunately, we can't do this for them. You know, we want to, we would love to do this for them. I would have done this for her all day long, but it doesn't work like that. My role really is to be a support for her if and when she needs it, and to also maintain my own recovery.
Mm-hmm. And like with any disease, prevention is far better than treatment. But for those who have a loved one with a substance use disorder, in the last like minute or so we have, what advice or words of encouragement do you have for them?
That we have to move away from that whole rock bottom, cut them off thing. And that we have to love we have to take care of and love our people with boundaries. You know, there's boundaries, but we have to love those that are struggling with this, because there is another way out. You know, I watch people all day long recover and have decades of recovery behind them. And my own daughter with 4.5 years and have wonderful, productive, happy lives from a point where nobody would have believed it. But we have to be there and be educated and support them.
Maureen Cavanaugh is the founder of Magnolia New Beginnings, a nonprofit that provides peer support, education, and advocacy to those recovering from a substance use disorder. She's also the author of If You Love Me, A Mother's Journey Through Her Daughter's Opioid Addiction. Teresa Manning is the executive director of the Martha's Vineyard Youth Task Force. We'll post links with more information about Magnolia New Beginnings and the Martha's Vineyard Youth Task Force at our website, capeandislands.org. Teresa and Maureen, thanks so much for being with us. And Maureen, thank you for sharing your story. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.